You're listening to the Untaming podcast.
We were the child.
Here is your host, Emily.
Hello, welcome back. I hope you enjoyed last week's episode with Kate Soulsby. If you did, I have one more episode in a similar style lined up for you in the coming weeks. If you're looking for some homework to do, feel free to watch the movies American Pie and Superbad in preparation for next week's episode. I will be talking with writer, filmmaker, and fellow podcast host, Charlie Brook, and we will be touching on some of the content of those movies. But if you haven't seen them, it's definitely not a requirement to listen to that episode. Today I will talk with Cornelia Holton of Korukai Herb Farms about, well, there were so many subjects you can see from the title. I ended up just going with foraging, permaculture and education because we covered so many topics. Thirty-five-year-old Cornelia Holton was born on the border of Germany and Austria, grew up in Bavaria, Germany, and currently lives in Pigeon Bay, New Zealand with her husband, Kai, six-year-old Nicholas, and four-year-old Julia. Cornelia earned her degree in education at university in Innsbruck, Austria, her master's in Montessori education from Endicott College in Massachusetts, United States. She also holds a diploma in organic horticulture, and in 2014, she completed an apprenticeship in herbal medicine. Cornelia is the CEO and founder of Korukai Herb Farm, a family business set on 15 acres with rolling hills and native bush. They grow and process over 80 different culinary and medicinal herbs to make herbal products for everyday use and to treat diseases. Cornelia runs workshops, grows food, and home educates Nicholas and Julia. Her day starts in the garden making compost, organic seaweed and manure fertilizer, sowing seeds, planting and harvesting. She does product development and together with Kai designs the labels for the products. The Korukai monthly newsletters are written by Cornelia and they give her an opportunity to share her passion for organic food, herbs, nourishment, gardening, permaculture and self-sufficiency. Last night she had about 9 hours of sleep and for dinner tonight she had a lamb rolled roast filled with spinach, capsicum, tomatoes with potatoes on the side and some salad from the garden. Cornelia, welcome to the show.
Hello everybody, thanks for having me.
So I first became actively interested in the benefits of wild foods and foraging last year and my mum soon jumped on the bandwagon. She's attended a couple of wild foraging workshops now and can probably identify more wild plants than I can. The most recent workshop she attended was run by you. And like most grandmothers, every child she sees reminds her of her own grandchildren. And so, of course, your children reminded her of mine. And because you and I both live lifestyles that are quite different to what is currently mainstream, she thought we should connect. So within a week, I have contacted you, we set up this interview, and here we are. Cornelia, being from Germany, how did you come to be living in a small New Zealand town like Akaroa?
It was like, 15 years ago, I was backpacking in Australia, and I was on holiday in New Zealand, and I just really loved the landscape, I loved the people and the easygoing lifestyle. And when going back to Germany, I talked to it was my boyfriend at the time, now it's my husband. And we set plans in place to move to New Zealand. It took us another 5 years. I was doing my studies in primary teaching, did a bachelor in primary teaching, and I did my Montessori education training as well. And after that, we shifted to New Zealand.
So had your husband, Kai, had he ever been to New Zealand before or did you just sell it to him?
No, he has also been on holiday in New Zealand twice.
He
also just loved the place. And we love mountaineering. We love the mountains. We love outdoorsiness and all of that lifestyle. So it just fitted in really well with who we already are, with who we were at that stage. And so we did it. We just came here to try it out for 2 years And then it just got more years, and now 10 years later, we're still here and we're loving it and we're raising our two children.
Brilliant. Oh, that's so nice to hear.
Yeah.
So our non-New Zealand listeners may be unfamiliar with the words koru and kai. Could you give us the meaning behind the name Koru Kai Farms?
Of course. Koru is the unfolding fern frond. So once before it's unfolded, so that just the shape of the koru. And it's the meaning is in, yeah, many cultures the same. In Māori, it's the, you know, the spiritual awakening, the starting, the chaos, the new birth of something new and exciting. And for us, that's really what we did when we came to New Zealand. And yeah, I just love that concept of chaos and then order after chaos and unfolding and love. So we took the koro into the name for the business. And kai is the Māori word for food. Mm-hmm. Also, my husband is called Kai, so it's a double meaning for us. And for us, food is our medicine, mm-hmm. and medicine is our food. That's what this entitles. So the better food you eat, the more nutrition you take up, and the healthier you'll be. So, yeah, food should be your medicine. And again, and medicine should be the food that you're eating.
Excellent. Yeah, I love it. Such a fitting name. So how did you first become interested in wild foods and foraging?
When I did the apprenticeship in herbal medicine, the first part in spring was just all about food, wild foods, edible weeds, and how we can just stay healthy with eating healthy. So this really sparked the interest in edible weeds. And since then, I've just learned so many more edible weeds that we find around us everywhere. Most of them are introduced species. And yeah, they are nourishing, keep you healthy. And just edible weeds are just so much healthier than anything you would find in a supermarket or any lettuce you can grow.
Mm, so they have a lot more nutrients than supermarket.
Yeah, definitely. Right? They haven't been tempered with. They are still the original form as they were hundreds of years ago. Our ancestors ate those weeds. So it's kind of ingrained in our DNA that this food is good for us. And foods in supermarket has been bred to have a better shelf life, to look better, to have a certain gloss or a certain colour. But mainly the shelf life is really important, so that it just, you know, it can travel over miles and miles, or it can fly to different countries and just stays fresh.
Yeah.
For it to get there. And yeah, and this reduces the nutritional value, because the nutritional value was just, you know, going down the hill. And it's, yeah, science has proven that the nutritional value of the food in the supermarket has lost around 80% of what it used to have just 50 years ago.
Wow, that much in 50 years. That's,
yes. Yeah. And that was from a research done maybe 5 to 10 years ago. So it's even worse now.
Yeah, gosh, that's surprising. You mentioned you were talking about weeds. So a lot of people probably think that wild plant foods that you forage are mostly just variations of leafy greens. Could you speak to that a bit?
Yeah, there's a lot of leafy greens that are available and that we forage for. But there's also flowers. There's fruits and berries. There's mushroom that we're just starting to dive into. Yeah, there's a lot more than leafy greens, but leafy greens is definitely the main part of the foraging.
I like it. Okay, so my identification skills are pretty basic. There are some plants like blackberry, broom, lavender and horehound that I could identify year round. But then there are others like borage and lupins, wild garlic, wild asparagus that I can only identify when they're flowering in the spring. So does it take a while for you to learn to identify the same plant as it changes over the seasons and know which parts of a plant are edible and when?
Yeah, definitely. And it takes a lot of observation skills as well. So when we know the plant is growing there, when it flowers and I can identify it, then I go back at a different time of the year and see how the plant looks like, or if it's even growing at this time of the year or not. And also, yeah, because we are on the farm, we are outside pretty much every day. Well, every day, not pretty much. And so we get to watch plants a lot more. And also when you go around our farm with children, they see things with so different eyes and they point out things that I didn't notice before. Mm. So I find that really satisfying to for them to point out a thing that I say, oh, I really don't know what that is. Let's just see and pick it and see if we can find an identification book or go online and research that. And yeah, and plants, they do look different from when they come up as a little seedling to when they grow big seed heads. Like I've had a workshop last weekend and we were looking at fettin. And it looks so different when it's in full. It was actually started to seed and the leaves totally changed. The shape of the leaf changed. The whole plant was different to the tiny seedling that you would see. So yeah, it's good to be aware of that. And I always pointed out to workshop participants that they do have to observe and be absolutely sure to identify a herb or a weed, no matter how you call it, before you pick it and eat it.
What you were just saying about having children around to point things out, it reminds me just the other day, it was 2 days ago, my son pointed out a flower. It's spring here at the moment, so there are lots of wildflowers around. And he asked me what it was, and I have no idea. But then the next day he had it again, and he was holding it up to me, and he had decided that if he broke off the head and he squeezed it between his fingers, it made a funny squeaky noise. So he decided that the use for it was to make a special noise. And I just like that use of using all the different senses to figure it out.
Yeah, that's so beautiful how children just make sense of the world around them.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's really good.
Let's get on to permaculture. So for the absolute layperson, could you explain what permaculture is and how it differs from regular homestead gardening?
Permaculture is a design process. It was developed about 30 years ago by Bill Mollison and David Holmgren. They're from Australia. And so their design process is really based on observation, observing nature and mimicking nature to design a natural process in a certain space so that it works for the plants you want to grow, that you do water harvesting techniques, and that you try to make a closed loop. So there's no waste in that process. Every waste is a resource for a different system. Like, for example, we've got chickens, and their chicken manure can be really smelly and attract flies. So what we did is we added lots of wood chips into their house, and those wood chips are neutralizing those smells. Mm-hmm. And the chickens also scratch up the wood chips, so they find bugs within the wood chips, turning them over as they go, and they're creating compost. So after about 6 months or to a year, we remove all of these wood chips that's full with the manure, with other organic matter, and then it just goes into our compost heap and creates really, really good manure, really good compost in the end. So you've got a problem and you're finding a solution for it that benefits the garden again.
Yeah. I've heard of it as being like a no weeding sort of technique. Is this accurate?
When you grow the plants in the right position, in the end you have to do less weeding because you're just shading everything out that you don't want to grow. Yeah, in a sense it is. But at the start, it's definitely not a no weed approach because when you get little seedlings, you have to give them the best opportunity and you do have to weed around them. And what we use is a lot of mulch. So mulch suppresses weeds and making a lot less work for us. So yeah, when you got a problem with weeds, you find other ways to go around that and not having to weed all the time and using other things.
Yeah. Like a lot of the issues in the world at the moment seem to stem from agriculture. Could you talk about how permaculture is different or is more beneficial?
Yeah, definitely. So with permaculture, you don't use any sprays. And the problem in the modern agriculture now is that we are killing the soil life through the application of chemical fertilizers, pesticides, fungicides. They are destroying the soil life, so they're destroying bacteria and fungi. When these are dead, then you don't have any nutrient cycling happening anymore. So you have to apply chemical fertilizers to get your plants growing. And yeah, so it just creates a constant need for fertilizers. And then when you don't have the good bugs in the soil, you get diseases, especially with fungal diseases. And then you have to spray fungicides, and you don't just kill the bad guys, you also kill the good fungi. And then what bounces back after that is the detrimental fungi. So you have to spray even more, and it's just really hard to get out of that situation, and you're dependent on fertilizer companies to supply you the fertilizer and the sprays to deal with pests and diseases. In permaculture, when you work with a soil life and you're enriching the soil, you don't have the need for any fertilizers, because within the system you're creating enough to get your plants growing, and the fungi and the bacteria in the soil, along with protozoa, they are doing the nutrient cycling for you for free.
It's such a brilliant, like, nature's way of doing it.
It totally. And you know, we are now learning all of these facts that come up with, like, Elaine Ingham with the Soil Food Web in America. And we're learning the facts, and we've got a microscope here that we are doing soil tests and testing our compost and looking at the life that's in the soil, and it's really exciting. But you know, we need to learn all of that. And I did an organic horticulture course to learn how to grow organic food. And we've got so many people signing up for workshops to learn how to identify plants, how to grow your own food, because it's just all been lost through the generations. Yeah, there's just that gap that we need to bridge again, and we need to learn how to look after the soil and how to grow our own food.
My understanding of permaculture is that it can be abundantly successful, but it takes many years of improving that soil to see the success. Can you talk some more about this?
Yeah, we've been on the farm now for 6 years. Mm-hmm. And it took us at least 3 years to get the soil up to where we are now, because we started with heavy clay, and it took a lot of hard work to break up that clay and get an organic matter back into the ground.
How did the children help out with you doing that?
Well, when we moved here, Nicholas was 6 months old, so I used every nap time that I could. I was just in working clothes all day. Whenever he napped, I just was out in the garden and was digging and planting and converting lawn into productive garden beds.
Yeah.
And now, just today, it was amazing. We're doing a horticulture bed, which means we've been digging a hell of a lot of soil to make a massive trench, and we're backfilling that with logs and then branches and then sticks, and so going from big pieces to smaller and smaller pieces, and then we're backfilling that with stick again. And they've been involved in the whole process. They both have little wagons and wheelbarrows and spades and gloves, and yeah, they were fully there, and it was just such a joy to watch that, how they were digging and doing their best and really making a difference and loving it.
Oh, wonderful. I like to hear that. It's nice. And that they really enjoy and helping. And
they really, really enjoy it. They are fully into it. There's no, we don't need to say, oh, you get money for that. Yeah. They've got such an intrinsic motivation. They don't need any reward. They're just super happy just to do it and using their spades, and they even forget to have morning tea, and and then they're really, really hungry at lunchtime and they just eat like crazy. Yeah, no, it's fantastic. And like last night we were, doing some stargazing just before they went bed, because now it's finally dark enough at that time when they go bed. And today we were just spending talking about stars and star constellations throughout our digging process. And it was just really good.
So in touch with nature, the children.
Yeah.
So you hold a master's in Montessori education, and I recently spoke with Dr. Darsha Narvaez, and she mentioned Montessori is an educational approach that allows more natural autonomy than mainstream schooling offers. So what is the philosophy behind Montessori?
Montessori is based on Maria Montessori's findings about 100 years ago, and her approach to education is a very holistic approach that sees the whole child. So it's very child-centered. Mm-hmm. And in the classroom setting, you would have lessons built throughout the day. They've got a work cycle where they choose what they want to work on. And the teacher is more like a guide that guides them along the lessons they want to do and the things they want to learn. And there's lots of resources where they can draw on, and books and materials where they can work on. And the teacher or the guide gives them lessons, and it's just small group lessons or one-on-one, just depending where they are at, and then extend their learning. But it's very child-centered and a really big point for us is that it's the movement that is so, so important. So it's definitely not an approach where the teacher is in front of the room and the children are sitting all on their desks and the teacher is just pouring knowledge into their brains. Mm. But it's, movement is just so important. And when I see Nicholas, when he's got a really tricky approach that he's doing and it's just really tricky for him, then he just moves and he makes somersaults and just turns and twists and his whole body goes like crazy. And that's just how he learns. He needs that movement so badly. So he would really struggle to needing to sit on a desk for a certain amount of time, especially at that age. So at home he's not restricted. Well, if we would be in Christchurch, we would probably still go to the Montessori school, but out here, we are like 2 hours from that school, so we can't do it. So that's why we've decided to do homeschooling.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was going to ask, is how are you integrating your knowledge of Montessori into your home education of Nicholas and Julia?
Really, my first point is it needs to work for the child, and it's just totally looking at the child and what the child needs. There's no pressure from my end. And Montessori has discovered that children have got sensitive periods to learn a new skill. And that's what I'm really trying to observe, when the sensitive period comes, and then grab that and then hold on to that and then do the teaching with that sensitive period, and not doing it too early or doing it too late. When it's too early, it's way too much for them. And if it's too late, it's too boring for them.
Yeah. Could you maybe give an example then of a sensitive period?
There's a sensitive, like when you start from babies, there's a sensitive period for walking. There's a sensitive period for learning letters, for writing, for doing math, for a certain type of math. Yeah, there's a certain, a sensitive periods for all of the learning. And that's all different for each child. You can't say that a child has to walk when they are one, or that when they're 14 months. It's that, and when you're babies, we always respect that. And it's the same when they're older. It's not, school doesn't start when they're bang on five, and it's just when they turn five at their birthday. That's when they're ready to sit down on a desk for 6 hours. Not quite. Yeah. But it's just different for each child, and then within the learning it's different if they learn letters, at what age and when they do it. And it's, you know, for some children, it's quite early. For some children, it's quite late. And each child is so different. So we try to go with what works for them. And yeah, I could see that, like, when he turned five, there was just so much pressure on us, and he needs to learn to write and do this and do that. And we were trying it, but it just didn't work. And now that he's six, and he's just, it's coming from him that he wants to learn and write and do. We're just observing that, and observation within a Montessori environment is just really important. You observe and you take notes, and that's where the further learning comes.
Mm. Okay, so anyone who home educates hates being asked what a typical day looks like, because it can vary so much. And I know our days here vary considerably depending on the seasons. So, but could you share with us how homeschooling looks and varies in your home during the seasons?
Yeah, typical day. There's no days typical.
Yeah.
But I can describe maybe 2 days.
Yeah.
One day, which happens quite often, it's they get up in the morning and they come down with me to the dairy shed, and we milk the cow, and they help with the milking, they help with cleaning up afterwards. And then we come up and Daddy will have had the porridge finished, cooked, so we sit down and have breakfast. Then after breakfast, they are usually very, very creative. They are very, very well rested after a good night's sleep. They had their food. So that's the time when I can sit down and do some teaching if they want to do that. And then we do letters, or we look at numbers. We work with some Montessori materials we have at home. And then it, yeah, brings us to around 9, 9.30, 10-ish. And then it's time when they get hungry and they get itchy and then they want to do something different. And then they have morning tea, which they usually prepare themselves. So they know where to get their food, and they just chop it up and they eat it. And then until lunchtime, they've got free play. But it's, yeah, again, if they are interested to do some more math or some more writing, they can approach me and we do that. Or it's just free play where they do Lego, they are outside, they play in the mud. They totally choose what they want to do. And that gives me time to get lunch ready, to make a product for Korokai, to answer emails that I get through the Korokai website and things like that. And then I can also just keep an eye on them and observe and see what's going on. And yeah, just that time to be not have a schedule is just really important. They are very creative, and they create stories, and they come up with so many clever ideas how to use their toys and how to use other materials from outside. And then we have lunch, and after lunch they both have an afternoon nap. And now Nicholas has maybe 3 naps per week. But he still goes to bed every time after lunch, same as Julia. And Julia is having maybe 4 or 5 naps. But they have to stay in bed for 30 to 45 minutes. And then if they're not tired at all, they can look at books, but they can't do anything else. They can't go to the other bedroom from the other person. They have to just be quiet, lie down. And most of the time they actually sleep.
So it's almost like a meditation time for them.
Yeah, I find it so important. And we've always just encouraged that they have that after lunch. They have a sleep down part time. And if they stop really sleeping in the years to come, then that's a time where they can read for half an hour and just be independently alone, have a little snooze if they need to, and just recharge again. It's so good for their brain development, and they're just so rested. If they need a nap and they don't have it during the day because we're out somewhere, then they're just really cranky, and it's just really hard to get through to dinner time and bedtime.
Oh, wow, yeah. See, I think of my son as, yeah, my son's the opposite of that. I think he stopped sleeping during the day at like 18 months.
Wow.
It's exhausting. And then he does sleep, he will be up until about midnight, who's just like too much energy. Like, I wish he would have a quiet period for half an hour or so.
Yeah, yeah, wow. Yeah, they're all different. But yeah, we're still encouraged to them to at least lie down, even if they're not tired.
Yeah, oh no, I like that. And it's good for you guys to be able to have that time as well to recharge.
Yeah, definitely. And that's just so valuable. And I can make a product where they don't want them to be present, like a soap, where it's a bit, you know, dealing with chemicals where they shouldn't be. And yeah, and just for me to have a wee bit of a space and do things that I can just be alone and not have someone next to me needing something.
So then after their nap?
After the nap, it's around 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And then they have total free play until 6 o'clock. So it's most of the time we're outside and they're with me outside in the garden. And they both tend their own gardens. So they decide to sow some seeds, or they need to plant something out into their garden, or they add compost to their garden or wood chips. Or we drive down to the beach and we get some seaweed for the garden. Yeah, just very outside oriented. And then we usually have a cooked lunch, cooked a meal for lunchtime. And in the evening, we usually don't get in before 6. And then we just get some bread and some homemade pickles and ferments and, yeah, homemade bacon, things like that on the table. So it's a 5-minute setup time and we can be outside as long as we can. And then we have dinner time. After dinner time, it's usually they have a clean-up time before they go to bed for around, 15 to 20 minutes, depends on the mess that they made.
Yeah.
So it's really nice and tidy for them for the next day to, clean and tidy. So then their cats can start fresh the next day. If there's something they've set up and it's just a really good construction and they want to continue the next day, then they can leave it on the side. But yeah, it just gets cleaned up.
It sounds like a really nice balance of freedom and structure at the same time.
Yeah.
Those are almost like opposing words.
Yeah. They need that routine, the daily routine. Mm-hmm. That gives us with the meals we have and things we do in the morning and the afternoon, but they've got so much free time and they need that so much, just being outside and do things that they enjoy. And they spend a hell of a lot of time just drawing and painting and forming words that they make up and writing letters. That that's totally their game. But for me, it's like, oh yeah, that's good. They're doing homeschooling stuff. Yeah. But for them, it's just, they just feel like doing that. And that's really good.
Yeah. And so you were saying how they spend so much time outside. How does that change much if the weather is really cold or windy or?
No, they just have proper clothes.
Yeah.
It's the only thing where we spend more time inside, if it's a big southerly coming through and it's pouring down heavily, which is not very often. If it's a drizzle or overcast or cold, it doesn't stop us from going outside. No. And my outside is my happy place. So I'm feeling a lot more better outside. So yeah, outside is where we spend most of our time.
So you said that you could describe 2 typical days. Was that one? Did you have another one?
Yeah, there was one. And another one is like a weekend, like something like today. Mm-hmm. I can just describe our today. It's like a weekend on the farm sort of day. We started in the morning and we went down to the neighbors and they have got a drop-off pile with wood, which they're going to burn pretty soon. So we filled our trailer with that wood and we got that up and we put that onto our hygge culture bed that I mentioned before. And we're going to grow strawberries in that. So they were very motivated to do a good job. And yeah, and we just spent outside doing that. And then that was yesterday. Yeah. And then we reserved some part of that wood. And after the afternoon nap, we got a bonfire ready. So we did a bonfire in late afternoon. and then cooked some salmon and some crayfish on the bonfire with the coal from the fire on a barbecue that we shoveled them over. And then we stayed down there. It's next to our dairy shed, and the cow was just watching us. We sometimes get her up when we have a bonfire. So she just comes up and grazes around the fire, and we sit there in our chairs, just, yeah, sharing, being together. And then we stayed there until it was dark, and then we did some stargazing. Yeah, and then after that, went to bed. So, yeah, we just went up to the house to grab our stuff that we need for food, but we spent, yeah, most afternoon on the bonfire. So that was a, yeah, very outside sort of day, and that's what we usually have on the weekend. So we do project together, a building project that my husband does, or we do something in the garden, and then we just, mm-hmm. yeah, we go outside and the kids are with us.
You've also got a cow. You mentioned your cow.
Yes.
Do the children help you with any of the milking or the cheese making?
Yeah, they come with me down to the dairy shed in the morning. My husband, he's working from home. He's doing software development. Mm-hmm. So he starts, when we go down to the dairy shed, he makes the breakfast. And then, so I take the kids down to the dairy shed with me. And yeah, they help with cleaning the udder, turning the machine on and off. That's their job. And yeah, opening up the gates, letting the calf up and down, and yeah, feeding the calf and cleaning the buckets. So they help with all of that. And with the cheese making, they also do, so they add the rennet, they stir it, and then they strain it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they eat it, of course.
Brilliant. I love it. I've seen it right from the start to the end.
Yeah, they love it. And the, you know, I love my cow, and I love to have those and the calves, and I just share that with them, and they're just part of our family.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we're always there when they give birth. And
oh, fantastic.
Yeah. And we have sheep too, so they have pet lambs most years, which they feed by hand and look after, and they're just running around with them outside in the garden and yeah, out on the lawn.
So how frequently would you make cheese?
Once or twice a week. Mostly it's once a week, and we do yogurt also once a week, sometimes twice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we make kefir every day.
Oh, nice, yeah.
That's around it, yeah. I also do cheese making classes. We practice natural cheese making, so we don't use any freeze-dried cultures. We make cheese with the natural cultures that are within the raw milk, and also kefir, which we make at home with kefir grains. And we use, the only thing that we buy to make cheese is rennet.
And is this, what sort of cheese? Is it soft cheese, hard cheese, or does it kind of vary?
We do all sorts of cheeses, but what I don't have yet is a cheese cave. So I'm limited with letting my cheeses age for like 9 months at 10 degrees, 90% humidity. That's my limitation. What I do is a Camembert and Brie that I do at this time of the year in autumn, and then I let them ripen over the winter period where the temperatures are just right in our porch. But yeah, to do more advanced cheeses, I need a cheese cave, which we are working on. It's on the list to do.
Oh, cool. Oh, that'll be great.
But yeah, we do lots of soft cheeses.
Yeah.
And the kids don't like the strong aged cheeses anyway. So yeah, we're pretty happy. We do, yeah, they like Camembert and Brie, and we do cream cheese and feta and paneer, which they really like too.
Do you just have one cow?
Yes, one cow. I've got one on the rise, which she will go to the bull in spring. And then we have two dairy cows. Because we don't know of our dairy cow, we don't know her age. So at some stage it could be that, you know, she just stops becoming pregnant, or she's just getting too old to getting milked. We'll still keep her. But we didn't want to wait until that time comes, because we don't know her age. So we just got a calf last year that we reared by hand, and we're training her to be a dairy cow.
Oh, wow.
So that's really exciting to start with a calf from birth.
Yeah.
And then train her.
And you were saying with your cheesemaking workshops, do you use the milk from your own cows for that?
Yes, I do. Yeah, I do. So for the cheesemaking class, there was a Saturday and Sunday, and I start collecting milk from Monday on. So I had milk that was less than a week old.
Okay.
And I just stored it in the fridge as much as I could. I think we had 40 litres for the first day and then another 20 for the second day. And that all worked with what Lulu gave us.
So 40 litres, so 60 litres altogether. And is that what you'd gotten from that whole week of saving?
We get more, but we need some to make yogurt as well. And yeah. And also the milk that we drink. So we got more out of it.
Yeah.
We're getting it, there was end of February. It's less now. At the moment I get around 8 litres per day.
Wow. Yeah.
But then also some milk goes to the calf.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to always, you know, take that into account. Yeah, at the end of the week, we had 60 litres to work with.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was more. She gave us more, but it was around 10 litres a day at that stage. So there would be 6 days milking. Yeah, round about that. And then I was feeding the calf with frozen milk that I had from the spring period. Because in spring, we got 22 litres per day.
Wow.
Of milk, which is like way too much to go through.
Yeah.
And so we froze quite a lot of milk, and I used that within that week just to feed the calf.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had enough milk to do the cheese making workshop. Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. With your foraging workshops, do your children usually attend those with you?
Yeah, they do. We both immigrated here from Germany. There's no grandparents here that they could take the kids. And it's actually really good that they're just part of it.
Mm-hmm.
It was hard when I started doing workshops three and a half years ago, because Julia was still so little.
Yeah.
But they've grown into that and they love it. And they're at the gate saying hello to people. And before, like 2 years ago, they were just really shy and didn't say anything and just stayed with Daddy when I did a workshop. And now they're right within it. And yeah, they're actually showing people what plants they can eat, and and they're behaving very well. People are very impressed how they've behaved at the workshop. Yeah, they're right there, and they're just doing everything, and they're loving it. When we say, "Oh, the workshop is coming up on the weekend," they're, "Yeah, yeah, it's so good." I hope it lasts.
Yeah. So, do you think there are many misconceptions about foraging?
It's getting less and less, but people just thought it's a dirty food, or they can't identify it. It might be poisonous plants that they can't eat, and it has no nutritional value because they're just weeds, you know, or it's something that's hard to do. They might not taste very good. I think that's what people were been holding off from doing foraging, and now it's just, yeah, there's a big movement now that people just learn that foraging is just really good for you, and more people are doing it. And yeah, my workshops in foraging and edible weeds, they're just booked out every time.
Oh, that's really good.
Yeah, that just people need to know that, yeah, how to identify the plants and how to use them. And actually just trying them, it's always so good when I do a workshop and let them try every plant we come across. And they're just so surprised how it tastes like. Like an oxalis, it's in their gardens, it's a big weed. You know, you've got a bad attitude towards that plant. And then I get them to try it and they say, "Wow, that's really good. It's like really sweet and it's sour and it's, wow, I would never have thought that." So I'm changing the relationship that they have with the plants. Because, you know, weed is a negative connotation to a plant, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, so it changes their relationship to the plants. And they kind of, when they start going into, doing foraging, they kind of become environmentalists, because they wouldn't want the council to spray all the roadsides. They wouldn't want the council to spray around the parks, because then they can't forage that food. So it's kind of, you know, double good that they, you know, they become pretty much environmentalists as they go and as they value the food that's growing around them.
Yeah. So I guess that's a way, because my next question was going to be, what would make foraging wild foods more widely practiced? And I guess it's like you said, if you can get to change their mindset of, oh, that's dirty, or that's just a weed, or
yeah exactly. But in educating them how to identify the plants and the different stages as they grow, and giving them recipes and showing them ways how to use them. Like when we do workshops, there's always a part that we cook with the weeds and that we make prepare the food for a shared lunch on their day. So yeah, that's what they really value.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds delicious. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You say you're growing over 80 different culinary and medicinal herbs on Korukai farms.
Yes.
Where did they come from? Are they native to New Zealand? Did you bring some with you? Where have all the seeds come from?
Some are natives, yes, that we use. Like we use kawakawa from we've got a regenerative native bush, and we use kanuka and manuka as well.
Yeah.
And some I've got from the herb farm where I trained as a herbalist and did the apprenticeship. That's where I got a lot of the herbs from. So just with root cutting, because most of the medicinal herbs, they are perennials. Mm-hmm. So you can just take root cuttings, which is really easy. Or I got them from garden centers. I got little seedlings. I got seeds from a medicinal herb farm in America sent to us here. And the wild edibles, they were just there. So they were just growing. I did not plant any of the wild edibles. And we, in the workshops, we go through between 20 and 30 edible weeds. And I did not plant any of those. They're just there. And we just encourage them to set seed, because then we have them in the next year. But we definitely take them out in areas where we just don't want them, or I just start a new garden bed and put in little seedlings, and then the weeds would just take over. So I mulch it and I do weed freshly planted areas. But in other areas where they can just be in the understory, I totally just leave them, and then we just use them in a salad and use them for cooking. So yeah, that's basically it. So seeds, plant stock from somewhere else, natives, yeah, and plants that were just already there.
Okay, so when you do these foraging workshops, are they on your own farm?
We do two different ones. One we do, I do it together with Peter Langlands, which is a professional forager. Yeah, he's doing that for a living.
Oh, wow.
As crazy as it sounds, yeah, he's a really good guy. And when then we're really out in the wild, so we go down into Pigeon Bay, or in other areas on Banks Peninsula, because it's a really good foraging area in New Zealand. And like the last one we did was a foraging tour on the coastal margin, which has got lots of different diversity of plants. And then we can go into shellfish as well, into seaweed. And we also talked about mushrooms, the last foraging we did. And I run the edible weeds workshops. It's pretty much a foraging tour around our farm, on the property, through the gardens. And we go for the edible weeds that we find along the way. Yeah. So I love to do it on the farm, because then I can also, people want to see the farm. I do a farm tour as I go and do the edible weeds. So I can explain permaculture principles that we do, and just walk around, and we discuss plants and we try them, and then we gather them, and we've got always a harvesting basket, and then we bring them inside, and then we cook up a storm. And so, and I prefer that to do it here, because I know that there's no area that has been sprayed, so we can safely harvest from the whole property. And I've got a big variety of plants that I let go to seed, and I make sure I've got at least 20 edible weeds that we can try on the day. And this is within a really short walk, because some people are not as physically able to do a long walk. So they can short walk, do a farm tour, and they can see a lot of edible weeds.
Hmm. Something I've always been curious about is, with the wild plants that you've got growing on your land, are you able to harvest the seeds and then scatter them, not to actively try and grow more, but to just kind of see if you can produce more of these wild plants without taming them, I suppose.
Yeah, definitely. And we do that. We've got one area that's our like fruit forest where we grow fruit trees. It's like an orchard that self-supports itself. So with other trees that are nitrogen fixing and they produce lots of organic matter. So in that area of that fruit forest, that's where we, like my husband has been spreading out mellow seeds. So there was one really mature mellow plant. The seeds were rattling inside. And he just went into the fruit forest and just, you know, just banged the plant around. And now we've got lots of mellow coming up in that area. And then in that area, it will self-seed again. So we've done that with a few herbs now. And it, yeah, totally works. And it's, yeah, they just come up randomly where they find a nice space to come up. And, you know, edible weeds and the weeds in general, they are weeds because they produce an abundance of seeds. And yeah, it's just easy to put them into a different area. But also, if you don't have the plant, if it's gone to seed and it's too late, you can just grab some of the topsoil area and just spread that around, and there will be plenty of seeds for them to come up in a different area.
Ah, right. Yeah, of course. It's a nice way of expanding that wild foods without cultivating it, I suppose.
Yeah, definitely. And you're not, you know, spending a lot of time planting little seedlings and weeding them, but you're just breeding a million seeds. And, you know, if 20 come up, you're stoked, you got heaps. And those 20 produce another million seeds. So you get even more.
Yeah.
And then they grow in the area where they like to grow and not in an area where they actually don't like it. And it's just really hard to grow them.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. I love it. Okay, so Cornelia, I will put links in the show notes to the website for Korukai and the Korukai Facebook page. But where else could people go to find out more or to get in contact with you or attend your workshops?
Yeah, it's the Korukai workshop page in the Facebook. That's usually best. And they on the website at the bottom, they can subscribe to our newsletter.
Oh, okay.
So then they, they get firsthand information about workshops that are coming up. And yeah, I've also got a blog on the website, but it's usually announced through the newsletter, and then they get to the blog. Mm-hmm. Just things out of interest that interest me and that I think other people might be interested about. Just recipes or using herbs and weeds. I write about gut health, about making kefir, cheese making, sourdough bread making, all of that.
Nice. Yeah, and I will add all the links to things that we've talked about and people you've mentioned. I'll add those in the show notes as well.
Yes, thanks.
Cornelia, thank you so much for sharing this knowledge with us today. I've really enjoyed speaking with you.
Hey, not a problem.
Do you have any final words that you want to finish on?
I just hope that people enjoy the outdoors more, and that they just, if they just grow, have a little pot plant and grow a little bit of their own food, learn about the things that grow around them, and don't see them as weeds and trying to remove them, but maybe see them as plants that are really helpful for them. Yeah, that's an encouragement that I have for other people. And thanks for having me, Emily. It was great. Thanks for inviting me to be on the show.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.